ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
These days, Glennon Doyle is the author of the best-selling memoir, Untamed, and the host of the popular podcast, We Can Do Hard Things. But life used to be very different for Glennon Doyle. In fact, Glennon's life has been marked by a series of big, unexpected changes. As a young woman, she struggled with eating disorders and alcohol. But then a surprise pregnancy set her on a completely different path. She married Craig, they had three beautiful kids together, and church was a big part of their lives. But beneath the shiny surface, not everything was going great. And when Glennon randomly posted an honest and very funny story about this online, she became a lighthouse to other struggling women, and a writing career was born. And then Glennon was travelling to a conference in Chicago, aiming to tell the world about her highly anticipated memoir, Love Warrior, which was the story of how she'd fought for her marriage and her family after Craig confessed he'd been cheating on her for years. But at that conference, Glennon's life changed again, in an instant. Hi, Glennon.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Take me to that moment in your life, Glennon, when you were in Chicago at a conference dinner. Can you describe who you saw in the doorway?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I can. So I'm sitting at a table full of writers because we were actually, a bunch of us were launching our books for the fall at this conference. So 10 other well-known writers and I are sitting around a table trying to make small talk, getting ready to go out to speak to, I think it was about 1,000 librarians. It was a big librarian conference. And the woman I was talking to at the table turned her head towards the door and the room got quiet. So I turned my head towards the door and there was this woman standing in the doorway, and she was like 12 feet tall, and she had platinum hair, just a kind of long on top and shaved on the sides. And she was wearing this charcoal gray trench coat with this bright red scarf. And she just had this cool steel confidence and this warmth about her. And I've never had an experience like this in my entire life, but every part of my being just said, there she is. Just like that. Clear as day. And now, please, I have no context for this, right? I mean, I've never even kissed a girl, right? This is not, I had zero understanding of what was happening to me. And then tragically at that moment, because there is no awkward moment that I am not capable of making more awkward, I found myself standing up. So everyone's just seated at the table. I stand up and just open my arms wide toward her at the door. Okay. Sarah, she's never seen me before. Now all the people at the table are staring at me, wondering what the heck. So now I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what's happening to me. I've been invaded by some kind of alien. Like, I have to figure out now how to get from this standing arms wide position back to my chair and pretend that never happened. So I did this bow thing that my family still laughs about. Like, I was hoping that maybe she would think that I just always bow when I greet people. So I did this very strange bow and I sat down, and eventually she made it around to me, and we spent maybe 10 minutes with each other that evening with all those other writers, only 10 minutes talking.
What did you talk about? Like, you'd never met one another before. You obviously were in the grips of some powerful force. Did you manage to make sensible conversation with her?
Well, I was just sweating a lot. I just remember I don't have a cool bone in my body. I felt like I was talking to the coolest person in the world, and I am a lot of things, but cool is not one of them. I'm just like, I'm sweating right now. I'm very warm. But so it's funny. You're the first person to ask me, what did you all talk about? So this is what we talked about, Sarah. So she knew because of my bio that she had read. She'd never read any of my books, but she had read my bio before coming in. that I wrote a lot about addiction and recovery, because I am a recovering alcoholic and bulimic. And Abby had just been through a really hard time. She had just gone through retirement, and she, after just being, you know, she's like Captain America over here. I mean, everybody.
Tell us about her, like, because this is not just any 12-foot platinum haired woman. This woman came with quite a bio of her own. Who was Abby? Who is she?
So Abby Wambach, she is an extremely, okay, so like your soccer star is Sam Kerr, uh-huh. Right? She's like, okay, so she's like the Sam Kerr of America. She is, you know, she was the captain of the U.S. women's soccer team. She won the gold medal. She, up until last month, had been the leading goal scorer of all time for women and men. She's just very
She's a big well-known. Deal.
She's a big deal. She's a big deal. But Sarah, I don't know anything about sports, okay? So I had not a freaking clue, not a clue. And so she said to me, and this is a little bit awkward because she said, so yeah, as I'm sure you've heard, I've been going through a hard time lately. And I was like, what? Like, where would I have heard this? She said on the news. And then she said, you may have heard it on ESPN. And I was like, I guarantee you I have not heard anything on ESPN, because that's the sports channel, right? Which I now know. And she said, she just got really honest with me. And she told me that she was having some trouble with drinking, and that things had gotten a little out of control since her retirement, and that she was writing this memoir. And that's why she was at this event. And her publishing house was wanting it to be kind of like a puff piece about a hero and sports and all that. And she said to me, you know, I'm just really thinking about, what if I just told the truth about my life? Because she was so used to having to be so perfect and shiny, right? And have everyone, you know, look at her as a role model, that she didn't think she could be honest about the real human parts of her life. So I was kind of excited because she brought up like a few topics that I knew about, right? Like, I know about being a drunk, I know about writing, and I know about shame. So I was like, I've got this.
So not so much knowledge about the soccer, but all those dark emotions, that's, you're all over that.
My jam. Yes, yes. So
happened in just this 10 minutes or so. It sounds like you both went pretty deep pretty quickly.
Yes, we did. And something very strange happened. I don't know. I still don't explain it. I can't explain it. I am just not someone who, even in my most optimistic moments, believed in love at first sight. Like, I laughed at that at people. So it's just, I mean, it's a little humiliating that I have to actually now tell the story that happened to me. But it did. And it happened to Abby too. So we left each other that night.
Well, just before you get to that point, because of course, Glennon, you were there to tell this giant room full of librarians about this book you'd written about recommitting to your marriage and rebuilding that family together. And you were meant to be delivering that speech in front of them and this woman who you'd suddenly just become inexplicably but completely drawn to. Did you change what you said at all in front of all those people?
Yes, I did. I am such a nerd. I had this was my first speech about Love Warrior. Okay. Like, this was, Oprah had already picked it for her book club. It was like supposed to be one of the biggest books of the year. And it was, its tagline was Epic Marriage Redemption Story. Okay. I didn't write that freaking tagline. So suddenly, 20 minutes after I've met Abby, I don't really feel like talking about my marriage anymore. So I did. I just changed the whole thing. And I talked about stuff that I wanted her to hear about recovery and about being free and being human, and stuff that I thought that she would think would made me cool. So yeah, I changed the whole thing. And that was, you know, it was really, really bad timing to fall madly in love for the first time, because this book was a big deal and a lot of people's, success was relying on it, and people needed my marriage to be a redemption story, right? To keep that thing going. So it brought up a lot of challenges over the next year.
Well, let's take a step back in your story, Glennon, back to you as a kid. Tell me about you at age 10 and why that was a turning point?
Yeah, I have little ones now. One of them's 12, and I just look at her and I think, how did I get so sick so early? I don't know. I do know that at 10, I became bulimic. I think I was a super sensitive kid, and I had a lot of big emotions. I still do. And I felt a lot of fear, and I felt a lot of I felt left out, and I felt a lot of anger. And I wasn't raised in a family or a culture that really talked about hard feelings. I just thought that people were supposed to be happy all the time, you know, and because I wasn't happy all the time, I felt like there was something wrong with me. And I found food very early, and food was something that kind of numbed it all out. You know, when I was in the middle of a binge, I didn't have to feel anything. And that is what I wanted for a long time, is to be numb, because I just felt like feeling all the pain of being human was too much for me.
Did your parents have any idea that that was going on for you back then, as you say, so young?
Yeah, so I remember, I think when I was 13, my parents found out. We had been visiting my grandmother, and one of my aunts heard me throwing up and told my parents. And so they talked to me about it. And I went into therapy right away. I think that I know now that things would have been handled very differently, because, you know, in the mental health community now, we know that when a kid is sick, it's just a signal that the whole family is functioning in a way that is contributing to that. But back then we didn't know that. We just thought if a kid was sick, that the kid was broken. And so the kid got sent away, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to therapy all the time. We tried a bunch of medications. But since it was just me on my own, it never clicked, and it just morphed into other things. And by the time I was in high school, my senior year in high school, I actually was put into a hospital, and there weren't a lot of eating disorder clinics back then. So I was just put into an actual mental hospital.
And what was that like?
Well, usually when I talk about that, people get kind of quiet and they say, oh, that must've been awful. And Sarah, it was wonderful.
How so?
Well, first of all, my parents were both teachers, so they had enough insurance to put me in a nice facility. And this is not always the case, so I'm not speaking for all mental health facilities. I know people have a very hard time in many of them, but the one I went to, I just remember feeling like high school for me, I just hated high school so much, Sarah. I just felt kind of like I was acting all the time, and I didn't really know how to talk to people, and I kind of felt like on the outside, and it just was, high school was tough. And when I went into the mental hospital, everything made sense. It was just like, we talked about how to be human. You know, we talked about like the classes were not about things I didn't care about, like freaking ancient Rome or whatever you learn about in high school. It was about, you know, how to communicate and how to tell the truth and how to listen to other people telling the truth and how to feel feelings. And there were all kinds of rules about how to take care of each other and how to be kind and how to be, it just felt, and I think I've always had this struggle between wanting to be free and then wanting someone to be the boss of me. Like I just, there was some comfort in the structure, you know, of this is when we get up, this is when we go to bed, this is when we do our art. It just felt safe. I remember when it was time to leave, being very afraid.
Did you come out of that time with, I don't know, a better way to handle what was going on for you at school or in your life elsewhere? Did it resolve some of the stuff that had led you to bulimia in the first place?
No. I think that, no. I came out just as bulimic. Like it didn't fix me. But I will tell you that it has formed my life in terms of, you know, the place that I found that reminded me of the safety and connection I felt there was in AA, right? And then when I became a teacher, I remember thinking, I'm going to create this, like the feelings that I had there. Like I've always been so obsessed with creating communities like little communities, whether they're recovery groups, whether they're classrooms, whether they're my online community, whether they're my nonprofit, communities where people handle each other differently and where you actually do talk about being human. And you're not always talking about this stuff that our representatives have to go out into the world and talk about all the time, you know? So no, it didn't fix me. I had a decade of sickness after the mental hospital, but it did form my future.
When did alcohol come into the picture for you?
I started drinking in high school, but it didn't get really bad until college.
How bad did things get for you at college?
Well, I mean, I didn't have many nights where I wasn't blacking out. I mean, that was pretty much an every night occurrence for me, from college through till when I was 25 years old. So, and you know, I had all the things that happen to alcoholics when they don't get, I mean, I had burned every bridge in my life. My personal life was a mess. I was really, really sick by the time I got sober when I was 25.
And what prompted that, Glennon?
So on Mother's Day, 17 years ago, I woke up and I was just sicker than usual. I was always sick in the morning, but this day I was sicker than usual and I kept feeling sick. And my roommate at the time had a pregnancy test in the medicine cabinet. And something in me just went, oh. So I took the pregnancy test and I was sitting on the bathroom floor watching the pregnancy test turn positive. And something in me just, you know, two moments in my life, the most formative and the moments where I heard myself most clearly were when I met Abby and this moment on the bathroom floor. There was no worse candidate for motherhood on earth. They're just like the fact that I decided, yes, I am going to become a mother is the most asinine, audacious. Like when I think back on it now, I was like, I guess maybe I was still drunk, like from the night before when I decided that. But oh my God, thank God I did. I just think there was something in me that knew that this might be my last invitation to come back to life because I was so sick. Just decided, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to become a mom. And I got sober that day.
You got sober that day. You started going to AA. What was your experience of walking into your first AA meeting like?
I remember my sister took me. So I called my sister from the bathroom floor. She came and picked me up, pulled me off the floor, put me in the car and drove me to my first meeting. I remember walking in and picking up. So there's these brochures. There's always brochures. Okay. There's brochures at every meeting and they say they have little checklists. Like you might be an alcoholic if you might be an alcoholic if you might be an alcoholic if, which is so hilarious to me. Cause I'm like, okay, I think the fact that we're here is like a pretty good indicator. Like people who do not have a problem are not like, oh, I've got 15 minutes. I'm just going to stop in the church basement and like sit in this drink crappy coffee with these people. So I always find that funny. And I remember my sister, we just get through everything with humor. And I was doing the checklist, of course. I think they might have them just so you don't have to make eye contact with people while you're waiting for the meeting to start. So I was checking off, like, of course, yes, 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 yes. And my sister said, okay, she whispered to me, okay, AA might not be good enough for you. We might need AAA. And laughed. And then, you know, my honest first thought was I looked around the circle and thought, I do not belong here. These people are not like me. These people are a mess. Because you have to, I have always been, I guess what you would consider a highly functioning alcoholic, right? I had a job. I had my eyeliner on. I had cute jeans on. Like I'm not like these people, right? And then these people opened their mouth and I was like, oh, I'm exactly like these people. And not only am I like these people, but these are my people. These people are talking about how hard life is. These are the first honest people I've ever met in my life. Right?
Honest people. That's how they struck you.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my God. Yes, 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 yes. So I started off thinking I don't belong here, and I ended up thinking I never want to leave here.
So you married the man that you had become pregnant with. You married Craig, and you're getting sober. You changed so much about yourself, really, out of that pregnancy test. What sort of life did you and he want to build together? How did you imagine your futures?
I just wanted everything. I wanted the perfect. I spent so much of my life being bad, okay? Because by the time I was 25, I just, you know, you don't spend your entire life as an addict and not just screw up everything. So I had just kind of screwed everything up. And I just felt like, oh, okay, now I'm going to be good. Okay. Now I'm going to be perfect. Now I'm going to be the perfect mom. I'm going to be the perfect wife. I'm going to be the perfect, you know, Christian lady. I'm just going to do all the things. And so we built what we thought was a perfect life. You know, we had our little house and we both had good jobs and we went to church every Sunday and we had more babies and we did all the things that, that you're supposed to do.
And what was happening inside Glennon while that perfect life was being constructed on the outside?
Well, honestly, for a while I was like, hot damn, I am doing this. Like I didn't even think I'd be like a vertical human being, but now I am like crushing this, you know? I am such a grown up. So there was a few good years of just glee and shock that I was, I don't know, successfully adulting, I guess we would call it. And then, you know, as the babies grew a little bit, you know, when the little ones are so little, you're just in crisis mode all the time. And you can sometimes not notice the big cracks in your relationship, or at least deny or ignore them. But the fact is and was that Craig and I always had a lot of trouble connecting emotionally, sexually, all of it. None of it was easy for us. And we went to therapy. We did all the things. I think there was a deep loneliness. And I do remember thinking, oh my God, like, what are we going to do when these kids go to college? Mm. Like, how are we going to, I couldn't even let myself think about that.
The kids were still really little and you were in the kind of mad emotional chaos of having three kids under five at home with you when you started writing. How did that begin? How did you start realizing that the way you were experiencing the world found echoes outside of you?
When we did have our third, I stopped being able to find time to get to meetings. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do anything. I just was like, how do humans do this? And so I never needed meetings more and I couldn't do it. Like I just, by the time Craig got home from work, I just wanted to cry or go to sleep. I just couldn't do it. And so one day I was on Facebook and I saw this list. People were doing this list. They were writing 25 things about themselves. And I was like, huh, I could do that. I could write a list. And so I wrote out a list about myself and I pressed post and I walked away. And an hour later, I came back to my computer and Sarah, I was just staring at my computer because my list from my little personal Facebook page had been shared like hundreds of times. And I had six new emails in my inbox and I had three messages right in a row from my sister on my phone. And that's always my signal that I've done something inappropriate that like normal people don't do.
Well, what was your list? What had set things on fire with this list of 25 things about you?
Well, okay, I'll give you an example. So here's my number seven. My number seven was I'm a recovering food and alcohol addict, but I still find myself missing booze in the same twisted way we can miss people who repeatedly beat us and leave us for dead.
Whoa.
Right. And so here is my friend Nikki's number seven. My favorite snack food is hummus.
So you were doing a very different genre.
I should have read the other people's lists first, right? It's like It was like, we weren't doing that there, okay?
Yours is much more interesting. I'm much more interested in your number seven than someone liking hummus.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, I wanted to die. I just was like, I remember shutting my computer, just trying to get it to go away. Like, how am I going to take this back? But later that night, I started getting, because the emails just kept coming and coming, and I started opening them, and it was so fascinating to me because they were emails from people who I had known my whole life, but I had never really known, because they had read my list and they were writing to me stuff like, okay, Glennon, I've been struggling with an eating disorder for 15 years and I don't know how I'm ever going to beat it. Okay, Glennon, my marriage is falling apart and I haven't talked to anybody about it. Glennon, my dad's had depression for however, and it's tearing my family apart and we haven't talked to anybody about it. Just over and over, me too, me too, me too. And I just thought, oh my God, like, we are so busy trying to convince other people that our life is perfect and easy that we are not bringing to each other the heavy stuff that we were meant to help each other carry, right? And this truth-telling thing, this shamelessness, Sarah, which I have been gifted with from above, this gift of not being able to find shame, no matter how hard I look for it, I can do this, right? This is something I can offer that unlocks people.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky.
Glennon, you had built this huge online community through your candid writing about your life. How did an email from Pennsylvania change the way you decided to use that platform?
Oh, I love that you know about that. Oh, I just got chills. Okay, so here's what happened. One morning, I was feeling really grateful for this community, and I had been reading this book. I always think that whatever last book I read is like the answer to all of my problems. Whatever last book I read is my new philosophy of life. It's just everything for like a week. Okay. So at the moment, I had read a book that said we need to use our energy, our feelings as energy. So like when we feel grateful, we do something. I don't know. So I was feeling really grateful. I said, I'm going to use this energy. I'm going to open up my email and I'm going to do the first thing that somebody asks me to do, because people are always asking me for favors or to do things or whatever. So I open up this email and it's from this woman who is running a home for homeless young mothers in Pennsylvania. She's been reading my stuff for a while, and she's just basically writing to pour her heart out because she's brokenhearted, because the night before, a 14-year-old girl had come to her door, the door of this home she's running, holding a baby boy, and she couldn't let her in because she didn't have the money. She's just heartbroken. So I write back to her, and I'm like, okay. It's a beautiful letter. I write back. I say, okay, I'm going to call you right now. I'm going to call you. So I call her up and I say, you tell me how much money you need, because I'm going to give it to you. This is what we're doing. She says, I need $80,000. And I was like, okay, well, we're going to need a new plan. Is that going to be a hard credit?
Backpedaling.
Yes, backpedaling. This is how I get myself in trouble, right? So she and I sit on the phone for a while. She's just telling me her story and just how amazing she is and how amazing these young women are at her home. And I'm thinking, if I have this community of women who read my work, if they were hearing this story right now, all of them would want to help. So this is when I started thinking, I am a bridge. I can be a bridge. Like, I can be a bridge between these women who follow me in this community and this woman in Pennsylvania who needs this thing done for this young girl. So she and I stayed up all night, wrote the story of her home, of these girls in her house, all the things. The next morning, we posted it on my blog. We decided to call it a love flash mob because, you know, flash mobs, mm-hmm. were like, I'm obsessed with these things. I'm really trying to bring them back, okay? So one crazy person starts dancing and then another one does, and then everybody kind of knows the choreography somehow, and it's so beautiful. And so that's what I was hoping. That was the energy I was hoping for, that if I just started this, that other people would see it and feel it and jump in one at a time. And so we told the story. We opened up for donations. We said nobody's allowed to give more than $25.
Why? Why that limit?
Okay. I think that that thing, that little part is why, because now through Love Flash Mobs, we've raised $27
million. $27 million.
Yes.
That's amazing.
I know. And the average donation is still $28.
So what's the thinking behind setting that limit?
A couple things. First of all, I am, like I told you before, I'm obsessed with building community. And I really wanted this effort to not be like one person swoops in and fixes it. Like, I wanted this to be a bonding thing between the community, like people in their homes having to wonder if other people would care enough to make this happen, right? So that they would feel like a team when they'd done it. Also, I think it's a problem that we have this idea that givers have to be these rich people, right? That philanthropy is something for people who have a ton, when that's not the case at all. Like, I wanted to make sure that a woman, a single mom for whom $25 is a big deal, felt just as invested as somebody else for whom $25 is no big deal, right? So I wanted to democratize the giving completely. And also, you know, my job is to figure out how to kind of get over the inertia of like caring about something that you read and then actually giving. And I think that something that stops people is the worrying, okay, how much do I give? And like, is this going to be enough? And if I'm going to give this much, do I have to ask somebody else? It felt like a good amount that you wouldn't have to overthink it. And so she and I said to her that morning, you have to promise me that if we have this money by the end of the day, that you're going to go get that girl and she's going to be in your house by the end of the day. And so I think we opened it up around 9 a.m. By 3 o'clock, we had the 80,000. We could not believe it. And my favorite part is I wrote her right at 3 o'clock. I said, we've got it. Go get her. Go get her. And she said, oh, Glennon, I got her 2 hours ago. I believed. I just believed.
You formed this group called Together Rising, and it begins there with that email from woman working with single mums in Pennsylvania, and it's just continued to grow. What kind of projects do you decide to work on? What gets your attention? What gets you contacting the women who are part of your community online?
So I really believe in the power of brokenheartedness. Like, I know that brokenheartedness is something that we tend to think of as something to avoid. You know, you always hear, I can't go there, it'll break my heart. I can't read that, it'll break my heart. I can't, you know, but I have found that if I figure out what breaks my heart, that's a really big signal that's something I'm supposed to go towards. And I think over time, our whole community has figured that out. So my job is to figure out what's breaking my heart and what's breaking the heart of women all over our country and now beyond, and enter into those places. So we have become very involved in the Syrian refugee crisis. We have become very involved in building shelters and getting mentors for LGBTQ kids because it's the fastest growing homeless population. We have become very involved in reuniting families at the border. That has been one of our biggest efforts. We're partnering with maternal centers for Black mothers because, you know, the rate of maternal death and infant death with Black mothers is so much higher than white mothers. We got involved in the opioid crisis. It's whatever is breaking all of our hearts.
Glennon, speaking of brokenheartedness, tell me what Craig confessed to you one day in therapy.
I think it was 10 years into our marriage. We'd been struggling to connect for a long time. I just thought we were having like normal marriage problems, you know? And then one day we sat down in an otherwise uneventful therapy session and he said, there have been other women. And what I found out eventually was that there had been many other women and that it had been from the very beginning of our marriage. So that was a doozy.
What What was going through your head in the hours after that about what that meant?
I think that I was in a bit of shock for a while. And then I think my reaction next, I thought was typical, but now have learned maybe was telling of the problems in our marriage. But I really went completely and totally into mama bear mode. My friends, when I would talk to them about how I was feeling at that time, thought it was odd that I wasn't more devastated personally on a romantic level with Craig, that I really went straight to how could you do this to our children, right? That I went into just fierce, like, I will protect them. I will fix everything for them. And I think that now I know that that's because Craig and I were kind of always lacking that. Like, you know, I think of now, I'm very deeply in love with Abby, and it's the first time I've ever been in love. I know that. And if that happened to me now, I can't even imagine the devastation I would feel as the personal betrayal of it. And that's not exactly how it was with Craig.
It was more as my co-parent, you've threatened our unit.
Yes. How could you screw up this unit, this perfect unit we have been working so hard to build? It was like how you'd feel if your business partner had just screwed up. And I didn't know all that. I wasn't conscious of all of that at the time. But now when I look back on it, I can see that it wasn't the reaction of a lover scorned. You know, it was more of a mother who felt like she now had to protect her babies from pain.
Where did you go from that revelation and that fury and fear, I guess, about what it meant for your kids? Where did you turn in yourself?
I remember a lot of my thoughts in the beginning were just that I felt so claustrophobic. I just felt so trapped because I felt like I only had two choices, and the one choice was to ruin my kids' lives by leaving. I mean, now that I, years and years later, after I have left, I do understand that divorce isn't the end of the world, and that divorce is often the correct answer and the healthiest answer for all the people in the family. But I didn't understand that back then. I thought divorce was the absolute end of the world. I thought that my kids' lives would be ruined. Craig was and is just an excellent devoted father. And my children adored him. So I thought, okay, I can leave and ruin their lives, or I can stay and be angry forever.
You had come so strongly out of a Christian tradition, which has its own ideas and teachings about marriage and, I guess, particularly a wife's role. Was that informing how you were trying to make sense of what to do next?
Yeah. I mean, I was a part of a church back then that just thought and taught that women, I remember a woman walking up to me and saying, you know, it is your duty to handle this. Her actual words were, she said, divorce is stepping outside of God's umbrella of protection. Like the crap people said to me back then, and I think back on my little precious self, like, oh my God, why didn't you just scream and like what were you doing? But yeah, it was heavy. It was heavy.
Were you confused in yourself? Like when you look back, were you in a confused space yourself?
I don't think so. I'm actually really proud of how I handled all of it when I think about it right now. I haven't said that out loud before, but I think that there was a part of me that knew that Craig and I had some work to do, that we really did have some work to do, regardless of whether we were going to be married forever or if we were just going to be co-parents forever, because it was going to be one or the other, right? I know that there were a lot of people who felt like that it was cowardly for me to stay as long as I did, because I've always been in this weird Venn diagram, Sarah, of like Christian and then feminist, right? So this is the Venn diagram of my life. And those are two.
There's not a lot of overlap.
There's not a lot.
It's a very little, it's a narrow bit of intersecting circles that you're having to squeeze into there.
Right. So one of side of my life was all you should go. One side of my life is all you should stay. It really was an excellent exercise for me as a woman, because there was, it's wonderful when you finally realize that you can't please everybody, right? That's a wonderful spot to be at, because that's when you realize, oh, all I can do is please myself.
It's funny, Glennon, even saying that, there's a reaction to me which is like, that's so selfish. And then I think, wait a minute, what is that reaction from me when I hear you say that? Did you have to unpack some of those, I don't know, that kind of cultural conditioning too, that doing what you wanted, that's selfish?
Oh, God, yes. Isn't it hilarious? Like, the only proof we need that we live in an unbelievable patriarchal culture is to think that the epitome, what women strive to be called, what the compliment we give to mothers, to daughters, to people is, she's so selfless. Like, Sarah, what the hell is that? Like, so not having a self is something we should aim for. It's so insane, right? So, I had to unpack all of that. I mean, so many of us are just struggling to give ourselves permission to live, because our mothers did not give themselves permission to live, and that is the legacy that they left. And we still equate disappearing with love.
This hard thinking that you were doing, Glennon, I mean, it took time, because you were thinking through it and you were writing this book, Love Warrior, which was you and recommitting to Craig and finding yourself through this remended relationship. And then you go to the conference and there appears Abby in the doorway, and that whole storyline just gets knocked for six. After that meeting for just 10 minutes or so at the conference dinner, did you stay in touch after the conference? Like, were you both thinking something had happened here, or was it just a daydream for you?
So we both, I was certainly thinking something has happened here. Okay. I didn't understand what, I didn't have any idea if she thought that something had happened there. I definitely thought it could all be in my head. I didn't know what was going on. A few days later, I reached out to her assistant who had been with her, and I did it telling myself that I really just wanted to reach out and like talk about the recovery thing, offer some encouragement. But I think I was just so desperate to talk to her. And then she wrote back this beautiful letter, and then we just started writing back and forth. And that's how we fell in love, through letters. We didn't see each other again at all in person until I had left Craig. We blew up our entire lives without having spent a minute alone together. It was all through letters.
Does that seem crazy looking back, or completely right?
Both. It feels completely crazy and exactly right.
Did you confide in anyone? I mean, did you talk to a friend or to Craig about what was kind of happening?
Yeah. The only two people I told the only two people I tell anything. At first, my sister, and also Liz Gilbert. Liz Gilbert, you know her from Eat, Pray, Love.
That's quite a confidant.
Yeah, she's one of my best friends, and she's the most open, loving, generous, wise human on earth. And so I told her very, very early. So she walked me through the whole thing as well as my sister did.
Well, how did those two women respond? Because, you know, that's a big thing to hear from someone that you love.
Yeah. They both responded with utter trust that it was real. They both responded with more trust that it was real than I had.
Then it has to go from this cocoon of love and trust to emerging to tell the rest of your world, your husband, your kids, your parents.
Yes.
What was that like?
I told Craig very early, and that was a really hard conversation, as you might imagine. But I am good at delivering news. When I know something is true, I just remember thinking, okay, I do not anymore. There's no part of me anymore that believes that I owe this man the rest of my life. But I sure as hell owe this man complete honesty. And I remember right before I sat down with Craig saying, talking to Liz. So I guess I had told her and just saying, oh my God, this is going to be so hard. And I just remember her saying, I put this in the book. She said, you know what? The truth is always kindness, even if it makes people uncomfortable. And untruth is always unkindness, even if it makes people comfortable. And that, I believe, is the truth. And so I sat down with him and just said it. I just told him. And he was really surprised and he was really hurt. And he was really wonderful, actually. We had been through so much at that point. And, you know, at one point during that conversation, he said, 5 years ago, you gave me more grace than I deserved, and now I'm going to return it to you. I want you to be happy. And you know, listen, it wasn't all like that, okay? Like, it's not like the whole time we were holding hands and it was wonderful. We had our moments, but we did always return to that. And he and Abby got to know each other very well and were very careful with each other. And by the time we had decided to tell the kids, Craig was able to say to them, you will love Abby. I love Abby. And that's just the greatest gift he could have given any of us, because he really did give them permission to open their arms to her and love her and not feel like it would be a betrayal of their dad to do that.
And she had to walk into the role of parent of these three kids. How's she done?
Oh my God. I mean, what everybody in my family, Craig, me, the kids, would tell you, that it's not like she was added to our family. It's like she was missing from our family. I am freshly stunned every day by this stepmothering thing. Like I have such an incredible respect for it, because it's just this very selfless, giving love that it's like, I've got to love them. I had them. They call me mom. But Abby just shows up for them day after day. She gives of herself 100% to them. She works so hard to build individual relationships with every single one of them. It's just really, it's the most beautiful. I think that stepmothering love or stepparenting love is one of the most honorable loves I've ever seen.
For years now, really, you've been thinking about and writing about race and trying to look square at your own privilege as a white woman in America. Because something you write about in the book is that there's a kind of a parallel almost between you getting sober from alcohol and the kind of sobriety that white America needs to face up to around race. How are you seeing that play out now all around you?
Yeah, I feel it. I feel it. I feel like I am a person who understands that when there is a real sickness, you know, like addiction was, like depression, that there is normally not a recovery until there's a reckoning, right? Until there's a rock bottom. And that's when everybody faces the truth of the sickness in the family. And that is what's happening right now in America, is that finally we are collectively facing the real bad sickness in our American family, which has been there since its inception, which is how our country was built, and then how it's evolved, the systematic racism that's built into every single institution, every single word that's spoken, every single room, every single family in this country. And now we are all looking at it, right? And so I think to people who haven't been looking right at this for a while, it seems like everything's really bad right now. And I would say for me that, and for my other activist friends, it feels like things are hopeful for the first time, because everybody's final, not everybody, but a lot of people, a lot more people are finally looking at our secrets, right? Are finally looking at the original sin of this country that still lives. And so I feel like, you know, everybody's like, oh, where's the love and light? Where's the peace? And the fact is that there is never peace until there is justice first, right? That there's no resurrection until there's a crucifixion first. And what you see in the streets, what you see everywhere right now, is people that are coming forward and saying, we are in pain. And so we will see how America handles that.
Glennon, just a last question. I want to ask, this kind of activism and this commitment to change and reaching out and building community and all the writing that you've done about your innermost feelings and intimate experiences with your partners and your children, how do they connect, those two parts of you?
Oh, what a beautiful question. Oh, God, what a good question. Somehow they're all exactly the same, right? Like everything beautiful in my life. It's like I spent the first half of my life running away from what hurt, right? That's what addiction was. It was just a hiding place. And then I started living the opposite way, like running towards, I wear this Joan of Arc medal on my neck just to remind myself that all the beauty comes when we go towards the hard stuff, right? That is how I got sober. That is how I had my babies. That is how I actually worked stuff out with Craig enough to leave each other with respect. That is how I do my activism. It's finding the thing that breaks your heart, finding the thing that makes you angry, finding the thing you cannot stand in the world and saying, I'm going to stand here. So I think it's so beautiful to connect those two. It's like all of the joy in my life has come from going towards the hard thing. And then there's the hard thing, and then there's the after. And the after of the hard thing is the real joy.
Well, Glennon, I'm going to let you go get back to your family and your activism. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
I loved this conversation. Thank you, Sarah.
Podcast, broadcast, Conversations with Sarah Konoski.
I spoke with Glennon Doyle in 2020. Glennon's most recent memoir is the wildly successful Untamed. And I really recommend the podcast that Glennon hosts with her wife, Abby, and her sister, Amanda Doyle. It's called We Can Do Hard Things. And there have been some further big changes in Glennon's life since she and I spoke in 2020. So check that podcast out if you want to know the latest with Glennon. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.